Okay, friends, the story begins. I am super excited for today's discussion because this is a very inspiring prayer. It really is inspiring. It's to me, I find it very uplifting. We're on the second half of the Aleinu, the Alkein, which is on page 81. And if the Aleinu is about what a Jew is or who a Jew is, the Alkein, the next paragraph, is about what a Jew's responsibility to existence is. So Aleinu, the first paragraph of Aleinu, is who we are. The second paragraph of Aleinu is, okay, this is who we are, therefore, right? The Alkein, therefore, now what? What are you going to do about it? We like to get caught up in Jewish pride, which is important, but to, you know, to talk about and feel and experience the pride and of being Jewish and being thankful, but there's a responsibility that that comes with, right? The Aleinu is about negating idolatry. It's about believing in one true God. It's about internalizing this true God. It's about prostrating to this God, right? Bowing down to God, which we physically bow during the Aleinu, but it's not just a physical, you know, when it comes to bowing down, there's hopefully the spiritual intention, psychological intention that comes with it. Who am I lowering myself to? Right? Human nature is to lower ourselves to things, to something, to worship things, whether it be sticks and stones, which was the, or stars and constellations, which was the ancient idolatry, and perhaps still in other countries, whether it be finances, whether it be fitness. Not that these things are not important, that God forbid they should be neglected, but they certainly shouldn't be something we lower ourselves to. Right? You know, in the business world, they say that the business should dictate, the business should control the real estate rather than the real estate controlling the business. Right? It's true in a faith perspective as well. Real estate or anything, it's not something we lower ourselves to. It's something we use as a function, but for a higher purpose. And if we ha and that perspective is a product of faith, right? That's a product of the Aleinu, which is a product of the entire prayer that had prayer service that preceded it. But what's the result of all of this? The true identity of a Jew, a believer in God? Let's read the paragraph. And therefore, we hope to you, Lord our God, that we may speedily behold the splendor of your might. Okay, look at the top line in Hebrew, in Hebrew, the second, right after the comma, second half of the sentence. I don't know, behold. In the Hebrew, it says lirot, which means to see. We want to speedily see your splendor of your might. To banish idolatry from the earth and false gods will be utterly destroyed. What we believe in the Aleinu is something we hope to actually see as an everyday reality. Now, what is this alluding to? What time era is this alluding to? This is alluding to the Messianic era. To perfect the world under the sovereignty of the Almighty. I'm going to refer to the Hebrew, which is the third line right after the comma. Letaken olam, tikkun olam, right? To fix the world, b'malchut Shaddai, with the sovereignty of God, the Almighty. Tikkun olam is very popular. People love tikkun olam. It's a good one. it's a big deal. People should love tikkun olam. People should live. Should people should feel the responsibility and value for repairing the world. But tikkun olam's half the sentence. Doesn't say tikkun olam. It says the takkun olam, to fix the world with God's sovereignty. Because if we want the world to actually function as it should, God has to be in the equation. The moment God is removed from the equation is the moment everything goes haywire. Why can't I be a, right? This leads to all sorts of questions. Why can't I be a good person without God? Why can't I be an ethical person? I don't believe in God. I guess there's two th points to this. It's a little bit of a tangent, but there's two things here. Number one, no. Number one, you cannot permanently. A society will not sustain true goodness without God. Because who dictates what that goodness is? Right? It becomes subjective otherwise. And part of that is the Torah, right? God's instruction. They kind of go hand in hand. But belief in God and belief that God's instruction come from God need to work together, because if you have God, but you don't believe that God gave instruction, then God is kind of disconnected from our reality. So if somebody believes in God, but they don't believe in the Torah, then they believe in an irrelevant God. Or they believe in the God of their feelings, right? How do I know what God wants? Because I felt it. Okay, great. A lot of things I feel. Right? That doesn't make it godly. Right? Otherwise, Diet Pepsi would be my God, or Diet Coke. Coke Zero, Mike, sorry. Right? Let's read the next few lines. All mankind shall invoke your name to turn you, sorry, to turn to you all the wicked of the earth. The world will be fixed, the world will be repaired, the world is going to become sacred and divine and godly. And the wicked are going to turn to God. Then all the inhabitants of the world will recognize and know that every knee should bend to you. Every tongue should swear by your name. In the Aleinu, we're bowing down to God. In this paragraph, we're saying that one day everybody's going to bow down to God. Everybody's going to recognize that there's a creator, that there is a true center of existence, a purpose of existence. It's something everybody's going to, at some point, recognize. Before you, Lord our God, they'll bow and prostrate themselves and give honor to the glory of your name. And they'll all take upon themselves the yoke of your kingdom. This is what the world is going to look like. We're literally describing the Messianic era, where God's sovereignty is going to be perceived and by everybody. May you soon reign over them forever and ever, for kingship is yours, and to all eternity you'll reign in glory. As it is written in your Torah, the Lord will reign forever and ever. And as it is said, the Lord will be king over the entire earth, and on that day the Lord will be one and his name one. Okay, to me, this is always just incredible. It's really the type of prayer that is all the way at the end. So it could be the type of thing you say really quickly because it's at the end. It could also be a very meaningful, inspiring prayer if we're able to take those few moments and really think about what's going on here. Our responsibility as Jewish people is not just to believe in our heart, which is the first part of the Aleinu, but is to hope and share that this is a belief that the entire world is going to experience. Now, we have a very different way of doing this than other nations of the world. Because traditionally, other nations and other religions want people to believe what they believe, which, by the way, is human nature. Right? If you have strong political convictions and you're into politics, you're going to make sure everybody knows that and starts to believe and think like you. And it makes sense. It's rational. It's logical. And, you know, it's that when we're passionate about something, we want other people to have it. And traditionally, I shouldn't say traditionally, historically, especially the two major religions, Christianity and Islam, have a history of compelling people to convert. And sometimes at the expense of life and death. But that's not what we're saying here. We're not compelling people to behave in line with our tradition. What we're saying is there's going to be a time where the world is going to come to this realization on their own. The world is going to recognize that there must be some sort of God. And they're going to reject idolatry. They're going to reject the gods they don't like, that aren't true. Which, by the way, this is fascinating. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. Atheists rejecting God. Hear me out for a second before you throw the tomatoes. Is that such a bad thing? I would argue that it might be a good thing depending on the God they're rejecting. If they're rejecting a false God created in the image of man, and because of that, they don't believe in God and they're atheists, We're one step closer. We're one step closer where we need to be. Right? The world is getting closer to perfection, closer to truth. A true atheist who's honest, who's intellectually honest, might just have a quest for truth and can't handle believing in something just because you feel it. Intellectual honesty, academic integrity. Right? How does Maimonides describe who God is, this God that we're supposed to believe in? Maimonides, in his Halachic Compendium, describes the mitzvah to have faith in God, to believe in God. And he says, belief in God means the belief that there's an original existence. This original existence is not dependent on anything, was not something that's produced. It's a producer. Everything that exists is produced from this original existence. This original existence is intentional, conscious, right? It wasn't just a big bang that happened, right? That even if one believes in the big bang, right? Where did all that matter come from? There has to be some sort of original existence. That's faith. Somebody believes that, they're not an atheist. They're not an idolater. They're believers. You know what it takes to get there, though? I think this is an important message because Pesach is coming. And one of the big themes of Pesach, of Passover, is questions. We ask questions. We have a Seder where we have this slot reserved for questions. We don't turn away questions in Judaism. We're not afraid of questions. A lot of religions are afraid of questions. You know why? Because if you answer the question, you might leave. Because there is no answer. Because they're built on lies. I'm going to be canceled for this, but it's the truth. I'm sorry. They're built on lies. This is just the academic intellectual truth. I'm not... So if you start answering questions, you start asking questions, it's like, well, no, you're illegitimizing everything we've been compelling people to do. You can't do that. But in Judaism, we're not afraid of questions. Even if we don't have the answer, we're still not afraid of questions. We're not afraid to say, here's the reason why this is true, and I don't have a specific answer to your question. I hope I will one day. So on Pesach, we do so many different things to try to get people to ask questions, try to get the children to ask questions. Because we love questions. We're not afraid of questions. Faith begins with questions. Our entire faith, the Jewish faith, started with Abraham questioning at 3 years old. That's how it started. How did Abraham discover God? He was born into an idolatrous household. He didn't go to Hebrew school. He didn't go to synagogue. He didn't have these opportunities to study, to learn, to go to classes. He sat there staring at the sun, or staring at the stars, staring at the moon, staring at the clouds and saying, where did this all come from? Who's in charge of who? Why are the clouds covering the sun? And why are the wind pushing the clouds? And why are the trees blocking the wind? And why is the wind, you know, what is the original existence? At some point, he figured out that there's got to be something. You know how long it took him to figure this out, by the way? There's a debate, but according to Maimonides, 37 years to figure this out. He was finally confident in his faith at age 40. From 3 to 40, Abraham was asking questions. We're very comfortable with questions because our faith began with questions. And I think when that dialogue is opened up, maybe monologue, I don't know. When the pathway to questioning for the sake of understanding truth is opened up, we begin to start enhancing our belief system. We start to become more comfortable with faith. We start to embrace faith. in the first paragraph of Aleinu, we're trying to solidify our own faith, right? The sentence, the last sentence ends with, fourth to last line, know on this day and take to your heart that the Lord is God. In the heavens above and the earth below, there's nothing else. It's not like God's in heaven or God is in earth. He created the heavens and the earth. How could he be limited to any of those? The second paragraph that we're reciting over here is that we believe that there's going to be a time where everybody's going to be comfortable with this truth. The world is getting closer. The world is getting much closer. Maimonides writes something fascinating. There's much discussion in the laws of idolatry of what the status of Islam is, what the status of Christianity is. Are those considered forms of idolatry from a Jewish perspective? Right, in Judaism, you're not allowed to bow down to idols. That's what the Torah tells us. You're not allowed to serve foreign gods. Well, how do you define foreign god? Foreign practices, what does that mean? So there's a whole discussion. Maimonides concludes that Islam, although it's not a true religion, because it contradicts the Torah, and the Torah says that any prophet that comes and contradicts this, you'll know it's not true. So when a prophet comes and says, I embrace the Old Testament, yet I contradict it. Okay, so you know he's not true. So it's not a true religion, but it's not idolatry. It's monotheistic. They don't reject the belief in God, and they believe exclusively in one God. They have created pathways to get there, often including violence and disturbing fantasies. Christianity, on the other hand, may actually be idolatrous. Now, it depends on what type of Christianity. There's differences between Catholicism and Presbyterian and whatever, all the different things. But if you believe in a person, according to Maimonides, Christianity actually is idolatrous. And he says that Christianity, on the one hand, he says there's an irony here. On the one hand, Christianity and Islam, he says, again, this is not a PC conversation, but I'm just telling you the truth of what Judaism says. You might not find this in other places. This is what Maimonides says. Maimonides wrote this 900 years ago, over 900 years ago. On the one hand, Christianity and Islam were horrible for the Jewish people because it introduced or reintroduced praying to false gods or false practices. It led to incredible pogroms and murders. Historically, the Christians were very not nice to the Jewish people. Currently, many Muslims are Islam is ideologically not nice to the Jewish people. Whether all Muslims practice that or not, fine, I don't know. But ideologically, that is a Muslim belief, right? Jihad and compelling conversion. So he says this was horrible for the world, not to mention that it's fake. Maimonides says, however, there is a silver lining. There's a silver lining. You know what that silver lining is? This openness to finding a new truth. Not a new truth. If it's new, it's not true. But this openness to discovering truth. Now, they happen to think they have discovered the truth. They didn't. But at least they're open to the concept of that this world, they're open to the concept of a deity. They're open to the concept of this world becoming a better place and the concept of Messiah. They're believing in the wrong Messiah, right? They have a misguided faith, but faith is there. What we're describing over here, that one day the world is going to be repaired. There's going to be goodness in this world. Maimonides says Christianity and Islam, with all of its atrocities and craziness and falseness that it brings to the world, it actually brings us one step closer. That's what Maimonides says. We see this unfolding in our eyes, over in front of our eyes. It's crazy. It's wild. One of the commentaries on the Siddur point out that not only is this a direct continuation from the first paragraph of Aleinu to our faith, it's actually a culmination of the entire purpose of prayer. This idea of repairing the world with faith, the world is going to realize that there's a truth, is something that the entire prayer service is orienting us to think about. But I'd like to share with you something fascinating, because I just learned this today. There is a commentary on the Siddur, an old commentary on the Siddur. I'm going to suggest it's probably between 500 to 600 years old. It's called the Seder Hayom. The Seder Hayom is a Kabbalistic commentary. It's authored by one of the students of the Arizal. The Arizal was one of the leading, by raise of hands, who's familiar with the Arizal? Rabbi Yitzchak Luria. Rabbi Isaac Luria was a Kabbalist in Tzfat in the, must be 1500s, late 1500s, and maybe even 1400s, I think 1500s. And he, much of what we know from Kabbalah is based on his teachings. However, he didn't write anything down, his students did. And one of his students wrote down a Kabbalistic commentary on the Siddur. And here's what he writes. This is just beautiful. He says that this idea of... Let's read. I'm going to read it again just from the first couple of lines from the top of the page. Right? Therefore, we hope to you, Lord our God, that we may speedily behold the splendor of your might, to banish idolatry from the earth and false gods will utterly be destroyed, to perfect the world under the sovereignty of the Almighty. Right? One day the world is going to be perfected, and there is that entails faith and seeing God. That entails getting rid of idolatry. So he says, what is idolatry traditionally? I mean, idolatry can take place in many forms, but traditionally, what is idolatry? Aiden, you just posted it over here. A monument, right? Sticks and stones. Idolizing things, sticks and stones. So he says, sometimes we become desensitized toward our faith. We understand conceptually that there's a truth, that there's a tradition, that we have testimony from Sinai, that this is what God wants and that there's only one God and that there's a purpose. I get it conceptually, but I don't get it emotionally. Emotionally, I'm just not there. I can't get myself to care. And my apathetic feelings toward Judaism get replaced with feelings toward whatever. And then they start shaping the way I think. He says that idol of stone, the heart of stone. We're serving a heart of stone. It's becoming an idol within ourselves. And we got to destroy it. We got to get rid of it. Right? When it says we hope for this day that we're going to banish idolatry and false gods, it's the false god of this stone heart. The heart's not, you're not supposed to have a monument, a heart of stone in you. We're supposed to have a heart that's open to truth, that's sensitive, that understands, that gets it. Maimonides actually writes in his Halachic Companion when discussing the laws of idolatry that serving one's heart is no different than serving sticks and stones. It's the same thing. Right? Offering fruit to Buddha, whatever it is, whatever the idolatry of the culture is and bowing down to it, as they did in Abrahamic times, is no different than worshiping our heart of stone. We have a heart of stone. It happens. We become desensitized, but we don't have to worship it. We don't have to make a big deal out of it. We don't have to take our apathetic feelings that get replaced with feelings for ourselves. We don't have to take it so seriously. We don't have to worship it. It's not necessary. And we hope for this day that that's going to be totally banished and we're going to be sensitive to the truth that we already know conceptually. This is what the Seder Hayom writes. When I read that, to me, it was just so inspiring because you could really get lost about thinking about this in a good way. Get inspired when thinking about this just while praying. I mean, you could kind of conceptualize, you know, the Talmud in Tractate Brachos says that the early... They called them Hasidim. It wasn't the same Hasidim of these days, but early Hasidim used to pray for 9 hours a day. because there's three prayers a day. Each one took an hour. They'd meditate for an hour before and for an hour after. And it's like, when you read that piece of Talmud, it's like, how could they possibly, like, what are you going to think about? There's so much to think about and to inspire ourselves with. I want to end off with another insight that I read. There's a sitter with a commentary by, used to be controversial. I'll explain to you why afterwards. It's not controversial anymore, which is it's an interesting thing. If we have time, I'll share with you afterwards. It's called the Siddur Maharid, Rabbi Yitzchak David Schneerson. He was a relative to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, previous generation or two, and he wrote a commentary on the Siddur. Here's what he writes. We mentioned something along these lines earlier in an earlier prayer. Therefore, we hope to you. What is the Hebrew word for hope? Let's look at the Hebrew side over there. Va'al kein, which means therefore, nekaveh. We hope. Kaveh, right? Like tikva. The root word is kav. That's what he says. What is kav? Kav means a line, a channel. It's not enough just to hope in God. I hope one day things will be different. No, no, no. You got to channel it, man. Nothing's just going to be different. You got to actually do something. We can't just hope. We have to channel. We have to make real changes so that things are actually going to be different. Because God's not going to impose himself on us. We want this truth to be revealed, but God's not going to impose himself on us. He doesn't do that. God is very modest. He is. He really is just very modest. He's not imposing nothing. So you know what he's going to do? He's going to wait till the time where we accept his sovereignty upon us. Take a look back in the English. It's 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines from the bottom of the paragraph. The line ends with and. Do you see it there? Right after the semicolon. And they will take upon themselves the yoke of your kingdom. God is not going to impose the yoke of his kingdom on us, because he'd be a dictator if he were to do that, not a king. In order for him to be a king, we have to accept him. So you know what God does? He hides. Because if I reveal too much, like I did at Mount Sinai, you're going to be infatuated with me. You say, of course I want this lifestyle. And it's not going to be the real you. You'll find a more shiny golden calf and cheat on me. But that's what happened. So God says, I'm going to be modest. I'm going to hide. I'll take a step back. You're going to channel me. And when you're ready, you're going to accept my sovereignty upon yourselves. This is the culmination of prayer, because prayer is just part of this process of internalizing God. And one day the world is just getting closer, closer and closer. Very soon, Mashiach's going to come. We're going to see this truth. We're going to experience it. Okay, friends, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.